Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited today to be speaking to Dr. Michael Hathaway about his book titled What a Mushroom Lives For, Matsutake and the Worlds They Make, published by Princeton University Press in 2022. This is a really fascinating book that pushes today's mushroom renaissance, a thing that I guess I had kind of experienced but never really thought about, into new directions. And it looks at both kind of the perspective of the mushroom and how we should be thinking about it in a very different way than Western science is perhaps often used to us making assumptions, and examining how this particular mushroom has radically changed all sorts of things in two particular places in China, in Yunnan and in Tibet. So this book does a lot of different things. And that's one of the reasons that it's an incredibly impressive book, as well as being very compelling and interesting. So Michael, I'm really excited to welcome you to the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much for that introduction. I'm really glad to be starting this conversation with you.
Could we, in fact, start that conversation with you introducing yourself and explaining a bit of why you decided to write this book?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. So, yeah, as you said, my name is Michael Hathaway. I'm presently a professor at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. I'm an anthropologist, but I have had a deep passion for the natural world for a long time. And I've been doing a lot of work on the kind of nexus of nature conservation and questions of indigeneity and indigenous rights back since the early 1990s. And then in terms of this book, I'd already done some fieldwork on these kind of global environmental politics and how they intersected with indigenous politics in Yunnan, and already knew a number of interesting actors in the area. But when I was there, I was always living just south of the major places of the special mushroom, the Matsutake mushroom. And I had a sense of its importance, but I didn't really know what an incredible player it was, like both socially and economically. And then in the early 2000s, I got together with Anna Singh, who's a professor at UC Santa Cruz, California. And she gathered a number of her former students, including myself and a few close colleagues that were really interested in questions of globalization, came often from a bit of a science studies background, feminist analysis perspective, and we all had a meal together, and she proposed that we do a joint project to study the kind of role of this one super valuable mushroom, the Matsutake, that's based on Japan, but it's now gathered all over the world. And if we could do a large-scale, long-term collaborative research project where we go to some of the major sites in the world where it's harvested and try to understand how this mushroom may be shaping local social relations and economies. And I was totally hooked. I was already pretty fascinated by mushrooms, but knew nothing about this particular one and didn't really actually know that much as much as I had fascination. But that started that journey almost almost 20 years ago.
I can see how that would be a very intriguing and sort of compelling idea. Like, let's go investigate this very niche thing that's having a lot of unexpected impacts. Like, are you with me? I could see that being, you know, the answer obviously being yes.
Totally.
So I'd love to kind of follow the trajectory, as it were, of the book. We're obviously, unfortunately, not going to be able to go into all of the detail that the book does. But I'm hoping we can maybe do like something of a highlights tour, I suppose, to cover kind of some of the main stuff. And so then following kind of the order of things in the book itself, you spend the first part of the book talking about mushrooms kind of generally, fungi sort of generally, and how we maybe need to completely rethink how we think about them. And so you sort of take us through, in a lot of ways, a new way of thinking, sort of that seems like it sort of developed as your own thinking developed as well. And so I want to talk about world making, which I admit I had never thought about in the context of fungi, not once. So I learned a lot from this. And I'm wondering if you can kind of tell us about your conception of world making, and the concept that I'm definitely going to butcher the pronunciation of, Umwelt.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell us about this concept and how it influenced your thinking around the world making of fungi?
Sure thing. Yeah. So for me, honestly, as an anthropologist, I mostly imagined the book being fully the way it is in the last half, which is a bit more of a conventional anthropological account, but, you know, with some interesting twists that we'll probably get to later. But with the first half of the book, it was based on a really interesting set of questions that emerged through the work, where I started to break away from just trying to understand the mushrooms as a mere commodity that is just enabling to human action, and started to think more of what does the presence of the of these mushrooms themselves, how do they maybe shape the world around them beyond just their pure utilization by humans? And so one time when I was doing field work with pastoralists who are in this region of northwestern China, they were talking to me about how when they were hunting the mushrooms, they were also hunting them at the same time as these insects, and that how the insects were such good hunters. They could detect the mushrooms before they were visible to humans. They could probably smell them underground, or some would fly from above and some might, you know, kind of wriggle from below through the ground and get there. And so, you know, almost every time when they would pick up one of these matsutakes, they would already find that one, two, maybe three species of insects were there. And the way that they talked about these insects as kind of like full of cunning and as learning and as observing the world, and then even in their very short lives, these short insect lives, that they may be developing skills, or that there would be differences between individual insects and their kind of hunting prowess. And I had never heard anything like this at all. And so after I was talking to these mushroom hunters, when I came back to North America, I started to try to dig deep into the scientific literature and think, is there any kind of way of thinking about this that is part of a Western scientific tradition? And then after a bit of a journey, I stumbled across some of the writings of, you know, an anthropologist that I had, you know, previously loved, but hadn't really thought about in this particular venue, and that was Tim Ingold, whose father was actually a mycologist. But one thing that Ingold brings into the anthropological realm is this whole idea that you mentioned called the Umwelt. And this is this concept from Jakob von Uexküll, who's a Estonian scientist at the turn of the century. And he had this insight that every species creates its own world through that is limited through its perceptual capacities. What kind of rays of light it's able to see, what kind of an auditory spectrum it's able to hear, what its nose or some kind of equivalent to the nose is able to detect in terms of the chemical presence and composition of the air and so forth. And so he started to do research with a whole number of species, whether it was the jellyfish or different kinds of birds or worms, and tried to understand as best he could what was their umwelt, what was their own world, how did they conjure this world into being through their moment-to-moment perceptual engagement. And so the kind of classic idea of the umwelt is that each species lives in its own bubble. And so I was really intrigued by using some of these ideas to think more deeply about what is the umwelt of these different insects and how might they be able to smell matsutake from a much further distance than humans ever can, or maybe even dogs can. And the idea that each species may have this really interestingly shaped perceptual capacity that as humans, we are often not as aware of it. Like we make devices that extend our senses, like we make microscopes to be able to see closely or telescopes to be able to see far, or we have different chemical detection devices that extend our capacity to smell. But bringing these things together then helped me to think, do these different mushrooms have their own umwelt? Do they have any perceptual capacities at all? And I was kind of surprised to learn that they do. But then as I started to learn about these different capacities, it made me think that not only do these different species of mushrooms, and they could be really distinct, have their own umwelt, but that it's not only the perceptual capacities that engender their action, but that their cumulative actions end up having a net effect on the world that is palpable and observable, and often not necessarily something that humans have tried to pay much attention to. But that those life-changing, world-shaping capacities are there not only in the insect and, obviously in humans, but in fungi themselves. And so I started to kind of push on this idea of world-making, which is a term that some academics often invoke from time to time, but don't really necessarily put together into a coherent conceptual level to describe the specific capacities of different beings, and kind of, especially in anthropology, there's been a move, as you know, like to break out of the deep human-centeredness and then to look at other beings. But usually that has only extended to, our close kin, like dogs, for example, or other mammals. So I was really interested in kind of trying to think carefully with insects and then out to fungi themselves to think about how they maybe make it both existing in different worlds, but also making worlds, but also in part through the relationships with other beings such as trees or the insects themselves, birds, and, perhaps humans, but to break out of that, the human-centered legacy that I think we've inherited so deeply.
So tell us, help us break out of that. You've explained that we probably need to, and that anthropology started to do it in some ways. But can you tell us a bit about how you've sort of broken away from that a bit, or started to think about kind of the ways in which mushrooms do perhaps, for example, have more, agency than we might think?
Mm-hmm, sure. Yeah, well, it's interesting for me, like you mentioned the term agency, and with my previous book called Environmental Winds, I was looking at these different struggles over nature conservation, especially in southern Yunnan province, right near the Mekong River and the border with Vietnam and Laos. And there, I was starting to look at non-human agency, but in that case, I was looking at herds of wild elephants. And so it was in this village where the elephants would come through from time to time. And the effect of elephant agency was just so powerful and strong. They would come in and they may destroy someone's home, especially if they're chasing a dog. They might go up and kind of wipe out a field of wild bananas that people had nurtured, or destroy a whole season's worth of grain in a single night. And so in that way, it was so easy to see agency as we usually understand it, which is a more like human-centered framework. So when I started to dig into agency to try to open it up to get out of either a human-based agency, which often has a certain Judeo-Christian legacy of intentionality and will, or then to think about it in terms of other animals that are big like us, like elephants, where we can say, we don't know necessarily about the elephant's pure intentionality, but at least we can see what it does. And it's a very palpable thing. And we can see one elephant doing this. But then, you know, in terms of asking this question of what does a mushroom do, what kind of agency does a mushroom have, it became so much harder. And so you couldn't see how it, you know, a single mushroom could have such a big effect on the world. So part of what I tried to do is to break out of a kind of individualist model of like the individual mushroom. And in part, I was realizing too that the mushrooms are just these fruiting bodies that are coming from these mycelium underground that look like roots, but is more like the everyday body of the fungi. And they are constantly spreading, and that they are doing all of this work, all of these forms of living, even while we don't see the fruiting body, the mushroom itself. And so just to think about these forms of kind of cumulative agency, that it's not these individual mushrooms that exist in and of themselves, but they are part of this large underground body that can be hundreds of hectares in size, potentially, that can be thousands of years older, that they are down there in their life. They are searching for water. They are mining and drilling into certain minerals that they can somehow detect. And, you know, they're going for like a high mineral diet of particular kinds of things that they are searching out for. Some of them, mycelium of other species, are able to detect nematodes, these microscopic worms that live under the soil and then are just totally everywhere. And they're able to lasso them and to kill them and to basically, you know, suck the nutritional juices out of these nematodes. And they're also often making connections with so many kinds of plants. Almost all the plants that we see in the world have are part of underground networks with mycelium. So just that through these active forms of life that all of these fungal species are doing, that they are constantly performing, they are constantly acting, they are making decisions about growth, they are imbibing water and, you know, potentially, for example, lowering water tables, they are infiltrating into logs and turning them from, you know, hardwood into soft, crumbly duff that becomes part of the soil. They are enabling the trees that they form relationships to above. But one thing that was really interesting is that a lot of the reading that I was doing was, even if it was talking about fungi and their actions, it was rendering them as passive. So it was just saying that in almost all the textbooks that fungi absorb their food. And so I became suspicious of this kind of narrative of passivity, or it just seemed that when a mycelium is just beginning, when it's just a kind of like a newborn, when it's germinated from a spore, it just seems to make relations with plants automatically. But then as I started to dig deeper, there is actually forms of chemical exchange, forms of communication going on between the mushroom and the plants. And so that those forms of fusion were not necessarily automatic, but were not always predictable, but emerged in relationship to decisions that were going on as an actively sensing being. So it was really interesting to be, you know, being an anthropologist, reading this very scientifically specific and a set of articles with highly developed vocabulary to describe it. But one thing I was really noticing was this deep tendency to render these really interesting different forms of life in passive ways. And so that was something that I was really curious about exploring as an anthropologist, to try to think, what are the kind of hidden ideologies that then shape the representations of these forms of life in the biological literature? And, you know, it's inspired by anthropologists like Emily Martin, who wrote, you know, The Woman in the Body, in part where she is looking at medical textbooks to think about how do they represent the differences between male reproduction and female reproduction, and often rendering female reproduction in very passive ways. And so, you know, reading that, those texts like that from a long time ago helped me to read the mycological literature, the literature on scientific literature on mushrooms, in a bit of a kind of against the grain way, to try to figure out, are there larger sets of presuppositions that shape the representation of the scientific facts, and that may even then shape the kinds of experiments that are carried out on the mushrooms. So that was something that became increasingly interesting to me.
Well, so I actually found that fascinating in the book, because one of the things you talk about as being one of these assumptions or presuppositions that you sort of discover in reading this literature in, I think it's fair to say, probably an unusual or unorthodox way, is how influential English, and not just English the language, but English as coming from England as well, influence the knowledge of fungi. And of course, we know, okay, majority of sort of academic published articles, you know, English is hugely dominant in that field. So when you kind of first mentioned it in the book, I was like, okay, I know where this is going. I did not know where it was going. That is not what I was expecting to come next. So can you please tell us, how has England and English influenced knowledge of fungi?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is really interesting to me as well. Like, I had, because I was in some of these, you know, mycological societies, I knew about some of these stories, actually, which may be then different than what you expected, about England, which is, you know, kind of world famous among the mushroom lovers of the world as being one of the most, we call it fungophobic or fungi fearing or even loathing cultures that's been documented. There are a few other groups, maybe the Inuit up, you know, in the polar north, are also kind of quite skeptical about them and quite leery of them in terms of poison. And I knew that in England, historically, there was not nearly that kind of deep tradition of loving to hunt mushrooms in the way that so many of the neighbors, you know, obviously like in Italy and Spain and France and Russia. I mean, Russia that has whole train rides that go out just specifically during mushroom hunting season, so everyone can leave Moscow and go out and collect a basket full of mushrooms. That I knew that England didn't really have much of a rich mushroom eating culture. And I have a great textbook that that was published right around World War II, when, you know, food supplies were dire in the UK and they were trying to entice people to go out and try different mushrooms, and warning them that, you know, or trying to encourage them that not all mushrooms are toadstools. So I knew that there was some of this, but the depth of the kind of fear and loathing that I got to learn about and reading into the, you know, the mid-1800s, a lot of these studies that emerged out of England were talking about this kind of, they call them vegetable vermin. And there's a sense that they create forms of death, that they were part of putrescence, that they were really associated with disease. So it was something that was often seen in England as like a kind of almost like a force of evil that that has all of these negative ramifications in their life. So it wasn't just a mere threat of, you know, eating the accidental poisonous mushroom in terms of an individual, but it was a kind of force in the world, a kind of whole a whole set of beings that were malevolent. And one of the stories that I tell in the book is how, you know, you already had this deep suspicion of these mushrooms. And then later when the potato famine happened, that was something that at that time they classified these as fungi. Now we don't, but that kind of started then this sense of, oh, these invisible beings, and they were often seen as, you know, part of the plant kingdom, and actually part of the plant kingdom until 1969, which really kind of surprises me that they were kind of emerged in that. Many people still think of them as plants, but that this form of life that's often invisible that is very threatening to human health, that can wipe out all the potatoes, that can wipe out all of these other food crops, that infests and infects grain. And so there's that deep British legacy of fearing mushrooms, of the rise of a lot of the first serious studies of mushrooms comes out of a plant pathology background. And what I then realized is that, oh, there are so many other ways to understand the roles of fungi, and that actually their role as these, I mentioned earlier, they're called mycorrhizal organisms that actually help plants flourish underground, that are so essential to many plants to really thrive. That was really relatively ignored. And even when early scientists started to make these kind of claims that these underground networks may be helping plants, they were first totally scorned and ridiculed as, you know, there's no way these kind of mushroom-like things underground could possibly helping plants. They must be pathogenic. So there's this deep kind of pathogenic bias that emerges that really shapes a lot of fungal studies, so that even to this day, the vast majority of academic mycologists have been within botany departments, have been within plant pathology, so dealing with disease. And so we just are only really in the last few decades starting to really flourish in terms of our understandings of the incredible importance of these underground mycorrhizal networks. So that's one element. The other element, just in terms of English as embedding a specific kind of ideology, I was more and more intrigued with. And it was the Potawatomi scientist, Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote an amazing book that's been a bestseller now for years called Braiding Sweetgrass. And a friend alerted me to this passage where she describes the kind of incredible powers and bursting forth of a mushroom that just kind of seems to pop up overnight, and describes the Potawatomi terms for that kind of explosion of life when it comes. It can even, you know, break through asphalt in some places, and how that's a really different way of rendering of the activity and life force of mushrooms than English. And she starts to analyze English as a specific language that is very, as you know, a number of languages are. Granted, this is not English specific, but as very human exceptionalist. So that was one thing I tried to even start to play with in the book. And I think actually I was not 100% successful in doing this. It'd be interesting to go back and see where I wasn't. But I tried to describe the mushrooms in terms of using pronouns that were associated with personhood. So I would, you know, instead of referring to them as it, I would refer to them as who or they. And that was, you know, in part inspired by Robin Wall Kimmerer's notation that in English there was this deep divide between writing that only humans were kind of endowed with elements of personhood or even had a gender. And so I was inspired by her, and also inspired by some of the early studies by Jane Goodall, where she was one of the first scientists to actually use gender-specific terms to describe the chimpanzees, and then how her paper was rejected. And the editor said, you know, we must be scientific and detached, and we can't be anthropomorphizing. We need to use the term it because you can't say he or she except for humans. And Jane Goodall pushed back, and she was finally able to get her work published. And she was telling them, like, hey, in this case, I am following family lineages, and it's really critical in this situation that I am referring to, you know, a specific social relationship, an aunt or a mother or a daughter of one chimpanzee over another. And so I think, too, that this was also something that Jane Goodall's work, and I later, she came to my university and I got to host her for a day, and she got to tell me this, the story, and it was such a thrill to hear how this happened. And that was a big, a transformative moment in kind of pushing science beyond its fear of anthropomorphism, that actually, when you look at it another way, is part of a kind of surprising hidden commitment to human exceptionalism. So that, you know, to only use gendered pronouns for humans, and then to kind of deliberately erase that for all other beings, is something that does that. When it comes to mushrooms, of course, because you've read the book, you realize that there are incredible number of gendered possibilities that are often called sex types. But so I couldn't easily, you know, call a mushroom a he or she. They were almost all theys, kind of plurality. But that was one of the examples of how English as a specific language carries with it a whole set of hidden frameworks that are rarely discussed. So that was English specific. And then there are also, of course, scientific specific ways that English has played some role in it, but doesn't shape. And as you said, yeah, so many of the academic papers are in English, but especially in the natural sciences, it's something like 80 to 90% of all the materials. So that made me start to think of how has English perhaps shaped larger ways of understanding mushrooms, of representing them? How has that maybe guided research projects and experiments and funding priorities? And how has that shaped the world as we know it today, the construction of authoritative knowledge? I mean, not only about mushrooms, but about many other species. And so that's, I think, part of what you're talking about in terms of the surprising role of English.
Yeah, I definitely. Thank you for explaining that. I think it really adds complexity in a lot of useful ways, in addition to just being really interesting and something that I think probably not a lot of people have thought about, or maybe I'm just underestimating it and it's really just me. Who knows? We will find out, I'm sure. So I'd love to kind of, as we've done a little bit, obviously not lots of detail, but some coverage of sort of the first half of the book, I'd love to sort of move to the second half that you described earlier as being kind of the more classically anthropological part, I suppose. But nevertheless, very much informed by these kinds of thoughts and discussions around kind of what is a mushroom in a way? How does it influence things around it and itself? So I kind of, the question I suppose that most came to mind to kind of bridge these two halves of the book is, can you tell us about the Matsutake mushroom and how it spreads, how they establish themselves in new places? Kind of how does a Matsutake mushroom come to be in a particular place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love to. So the Matsutake, for those people that don't know it, and it is sold sometimes in the fall, around October, in some fancy London restaurants. So if you're there, you can definitely try it sometime if you haven't already. It appears quite prolifically in British Columbia, where I am, and just a handful of places around the world. And it's this lovely, strong, white, fleshy mushroom that has certain these mycorrhizal relationships either with forms of oak or with pine trees, and it has this very, very special smell about it, and it has an oil in it that scientists have only ever detected in this one species, and it's called even like Matsutake soul, and it is very spicy and cinnamony and just so distinctive. There are a number of mushrooms that actually grow near it that look almost identical, but none of them have this smell. And it is something then that different insects or, you know, slugs have also kind of honed in on, so that it's part of the multi-species competitive hunting that goes on. And it's a mushroom that doesn't really like the tropics. It likes more of a temperate climate. One of the interesting stories in Yunnan province where I saw it is that I kind of realized in trying to, like, in the first half of the book, to think in terms of deep time, to think in terms of tens or hundreds of millions of years, it helped me to realize that, you know, Matsutake could not have been growing there forever, that Matsutake is on the move. And it also helped me to then rethink the biological, you know, habitat maps that you see of species. And they're almost always presented as statically, as, you know, this species lives here, this species lives here. And almost never, I realized, on the maps, do they show a timeline? Do they show or any kind of movement of how these species moved? And so kind of thinking of this place that used to be quite tropical and, you know, very close to, you know, if you think of where Vietnam and Laos, that was the kind of basic condition. But then reading how what we now know as India today was a separate island, and it, through tectonic plate movements, it moved quite rapidly and with quite a lot of force up north, and it smashed into this low-lying tropical area. But the collision of that smash over many millions of years has created the Himalayan mountains. And the Himalayan mountains then created the what some people call the third pole. These, you know, obviously we know huge areas of glaciers and cold. And there was then a certain ring on that mountain that pine trees and oak trees that could be the host for Matsutake found conducive to living. And somehow they got there. And then somehow the Matsutake also got there. So this is a place that historically would have been totally inhospitable to Matsutake, but the crash of India and the creation of the Himalayas allowed the potentiality for Matsutake. And it's an interesting kind of chicken and egg question always that's not fully solvable, but do the trees that are often called the hosts come first, or does the Matsutake or other forms of mycorrhizal fungi that really enable these trees to thrive come first, or these kind of interesting puzzles, because they also seem in many ways deeply symbiotic, so that they kind of need each other. But the pines and oaks can make relationship with many, many different kinds of mushrooms, so it doesn't need the Matsutake, whereas the Matsutake, pretty much when the spores land, they fairly quickly need to find these relationships with compatible species of trees that they fuse to. And the whole question of how they got there is really intriguing. I drew from some, you know, speculative, you know, as most of this kind of older evolutionary work is, on the distribution of mushrooms, and that it used DNA patterns to find clusters and then to make speculations around movement. And so one of the ideas is that, you know, the spores that, you know, kind of rain out of mushrooms, and by the way, right, they are literally shot out of the mushrooms with incredible force compared to the usual depiction of them just kind of gently falling, that they can sometimes, I realized, even though most of them will land quite close, sometimes they will actually generate their own wind patterns to get up outside of the cap. And through passing winds, they can sometimes go up high into atmospheric currents. So they have the capacity to jump continents. And we do know that this happens. And so it's incredibly rare that, you know, they can survive these transcontinental journeys. There's a lot of desiccation possibility. There's a lot of intense UV light that can be damaging to certain spores. But somehow, in some way, those spores are able to find new habitats. So if you look on a map, you can see that Matsutake are not contiguous in any area. So this is a kind of island. And so somehow they arrive. But then once they arrive, they form these underground networks, and they also then spread through the underground. And one of the interesting things I found about it is that they can then spread on the underground by enabling and fostering the spread of forest. They can help the tree's health. They can, you know, provide all this important water. And the fungi, the mycelium, have these incredibly fine little threads that are so much finer than even the thinnest plant roots. And so they are able to extract water that for a tree would be utterly unextractable, would be so bound up in the clays. And so they, especially during the drought, the underground mycelia are able to, you know, find this critical water. They are able to literally drill holes through grains of phosphorus-bearing sand, and then to use these digestive juices to extrude them, and then to actively pull in these nutrients so that they're helping these trees grow, so that it's not just a static form. And one of the other interesting things in terms of how do they kind of come into this being, I was realizing that sometimes there are these new species of trees that evolve there, and Matsutake will move from one place to another place, and they will literally have to search out and make new partners with other species. And that was another thing that I found really kind of lacking in most of the biological literature, that again would not only take the habitats as relatively static, but would say, you know, Matsutake form relationships, say, with these 10 kinds of trees. But then to be realizing that Matsutake are all over the world, and they are actually in creating new relationships with new species of trees, so that this is a kind of ongoing dynamic set of relationships. And so there became these very prolific bands of Matsutake around the Himalayas, and what used to be a long time ago a tropical place in which Matsutake totally couldn't have been. So that was really interesting to me, to think about how they got there, how they start to move both above ground and underground. That was a very different way of understanding history compared to my earlier work there, where I was thinking more in terms of a century or two.
Fascinating. So many different variables, and so much in a lot of ways that we still don't know, but really quite interesting. So thank you for explaining that. I'd love to kind of think about then the places where obviously the Matsutake are. And one of them, one kind of community you focus on that you've mentioned already, is the Yi community in Yunnan in southern China. So can you tell us about how the Matsutake trade has impacted these groups in Yunnan?
Sure. Yeah. So the Yi were a group that I had not worked with historically. My supervisor back in graduate school at Michigan, Eric Mugler, had done a lot of work with Yi in Chuxiang County in this region. And so I had some kind of background familiarity. But going to these places, it was really interesting to see that, you know, people were just so thrilled that they had lucked out, that the areas that they lived in were some of the best Matsutake habitat in all of China, and that the mushrooms were there. But I also realized for the mushrooms to be part of the best Matsutake habitat, for us to know this, it requires people to pick them, and people have to get up early in the morning and go out and find them and basically rush them to market, and sometimes up to 8 or 9 or 10 steps all the way down finally to from one person to the next to get them to the airport to ship them off to Japan, because the mushrooms can never be frozen. And so they're constantly starting to decay. And so it's this incredible speed of movement of Matsutake from these high Himalayan mountains down to the major airport of Kunming and then flown off to Tokyo or Kyoto. So for the E people, they're relatively, you know, in the middle range, altitudinal, and the Tibetans are often up higher. They're Tibetans are our neighbors just a bit away. But they've been in this area for a long, long time, and they've figured out ways to negotiate their lives with the Han Chinese majority. And so in a lot of the histories, the Yi kind of had to abandon some of their lower terrace areas, the place that were the best for irrigated agriculture, as the Han military or other merchants moved in as part of the governmental apparatus connected in some ways. And so the Yi have often been seen as kind of impoverished mountain dwellers who herd yaks and kind of live at the edge of the kind of bustling Han economy. And so one thing that I found really interesting is that these Yi Matsutake dealers were telling me that, oh yeah, this represents a whole new thing for us. They said before, if you wanted to get a good job, you had to really switch from speaking Yi to speaking Mandarin. And so, you know, our kids are able to go to schools. The schools here are not so great, but, and there's a kind of bias and against them in the realm of professional activity. And so it's difficult in schools. It's difficult to get a good job. There's a kind of stigma against Yi, and you can really only, you know, make a decent life if you are speaking Mandarin and are engaged in this way, but it's still hard. And so some of them said that what Matsutake did is that starting in the 80s, it became incredibly lucrative and became a way that they could create an e-linguistic kind of bubble where the dealers would be situated in these towns, and then they would send their agents could drive up far into the mountain, and then they'd have higher agents above higher in the mountain, and everything could be done in the E language. And one could stay at home and be supported by one's community and not face any of the kind of discrimination or stigma that would sometimes happen if they're going into the bigger towns when they're mostly kind of working for Han bosses. And that people started to also to expect the bosses to spend their money locally. And so some of the bosses were making their own tourist sites that would be, you know, give them a different kind of autonomy so that, again, like a kind of e-controlled tourism company with e-foods and e-cultural activities like singing and dancing. And so that it created this sense of a reinvestment of the money in the economy and this possibility of really one of the first that happened for a long time of creating vibrant forms of community support and a kind of revitalization. And so some people were saying that like the demand for music and so really expanded and dances and other kinds of festivals, and that it used to be something that would fully be organized in a very official way by Han cadres, government officials, but that it increasingly became more and more something that was done locally. And almost all of the managers of these were the same people that were in charge of the Matsutake economy, so that it became thousands and thousands of people in these E areas who could all make some kind of a living during the fall Matsutake season. And they also then too started to branch into other mushrooms. It became this kind of like kingdom of mushrooms, as they were also picking lots and lots of other mushrooms during other times of year, starting to get into the truffle market or creating this powder that they would ship to Italy and that would become later resold as Italian mushroom powder, that it became part of a thriving e-linguistic community where those kind of values and those kinds of relationships and a base level of newly found wealth were possible in part by matsutake, but also other mushrooms. And so this is kind of a whole hidden world that I saw emerging that, you know, could easily not be noticed, that one could pass that by. But that's part of the story of the E and the matsutake.
And having clearly quite a huge impact, even if you could pass it by and not notice, clearly within the community, there's a lot going on by virtue of being so involved in trading, hunting down the matsutake. So I'm wondering if you can maybe tell us a bit about the Tibetan experience. In what ways might it be similar as the Yi, and what are some of the dynamics that are perhaps more unique to the Tibetan involvement in the matsutake economy?
Mm-hmm, for sure. Yeah, well, it's interesting with the Tibetan economy. They were also in, as you know, kind of relatively lower social status position vis-a-vis the Han living in town. So both kind of in terms of forms of discrimination for work, or in terms of lower access to capital, or well-paying jobs, and part of a longer-term dynamic. And a lot of the Tibetans also were really interested in their own forms of autonomy. And so, in this place, yak herding was still a critical aspect of their lives that was going on. But for Tibetans, one of the interesting things that one of my colleagues, David Arora, who is an incredible self-taught scholar of mushrooms that I knew from California, that he had noted, was when the Tibetans started getting into matsutake, they often were investing these incredible sums of money in these giant homes. And so these homes that were called matsutake mansions were just kind of going up one after the other in these areas. And part of it, what I learned later, was that, some of the matriarchs of the family, the mothers and the grandmothers, were saying, we have all of this wealth coming in. How do we make sure it's not just frittered away? It's not just gambled away, or just kind of quickly comes and quickly goes. And, this is a part of the world too, right, where there are a number of boom bust economies. There's a kind of legacy of that. So there was a sense of this could be a boom, but this may also go away quickly. But so one of the things that I saw with Tibetans is that they would build these incredible homes. And so there was a great kind of pride in that, this resurgence of architecture. And then one of the surprising elements of this was that in some of the towns I was in, then they were hiring craftspeople to do these beautiful, Buddhist paintings inside, to carve these elaborate windows all over. And they were hiring a lot of Han people from Sichuan to do this. And there was a certain kind of pleasure for these Tibetans in these rural areas to be hiring Han to carve in their way, to paint in their way, to learn their styles. And so there's a kind of interesting dynamic, a kind of reversal of long expected sedimented hierarchies of social relations that was really kind of satisfying. And another thing that people did with this money was to invest in their children for religious training. So it started to connect this Tibetan region, which is in Yunnan proper, and to foster their children to go to do monastery training in Tibetan Autonomous Region, in Qinghai, and all these places throughout the broader Tibetan diaspora. And so they were saying that they had often felt relatively isolated from this larger diaspora, where they used to be much more connected. And matsutake money was a key way in which they were kind of investing in their children and kind of reestablishing themselves as part of this rich, diverse Tibetan social world. And then another thing that they would do sometimes is invest the money into trucks. And so this is often a very kind of incredibly dangerous thing because you're driving on these, you know, very steep roads along the edge of the Himalayas. Especially if you're driving during the monsoon season, there are lots of mudslides. There are no guardrails. It's very precipitous. There are a lot of places where the road isn't exactly two trucks wide, so you have to be watching. But a lot of them were saying that being able to invest in the trucks was a kind of resuscitation of their ancient trading networks. And they were saying that, you know, this is something that they had done historically. They were transnational traders, and they were often moving, you know, valuable goods such as tea and hammered copper and other kinds of precious goods up over these incredibly high elevation mountain pathways, sometimes coming from Southeast Asia, up all the way into Tibet proper, and then down into India. And so for some of them, being able to buy these trucks that otherwise, you know, is incredibly hard to come up with this kind of money, and Matsutake was the only way possible, that there was a certain kind of pride and kind of re-inhabiting their territory as these, the kind of like the king of the road, and people that were like transporting goods in these trucks that reminded them of their, of a proud legacy of moving valuable goods across, you know, imperial lines or national lines. And so, yeah, it definitely led to something of a kind of a Tibetan revival in the places where the Matsutake was really prolific. And, but on the other hand, one of the interesting things too about Matsutake is its very specific needs that are beyond human possibilities of control or management. So you'd have, you know, one Tibetan village that would become quite wealthy through the Matsutake wealth, and just, you know, maybe 10 or 20 kilometers away, you have another one of the about the same size, and the forest looks about the same, but for one reason or another, the Matsutake would never really fruit prolifically there, and that village would kind of remain economically poor. And so it also sometimes created different tensions between villages, but the effect was just totally dramatic, and it still kind of goes on today, although everybody still realizes that their fortunes have become hitched to the kind of Japanese economy, and they've watched the prices go up and down, and they're trying to figure out family by family whether or not they get rid of their herds of yaks and really devote themselves to the Matsutake harvest in the fall, or how do they try to figure out what the future may bring, both, you know, ecologically and also economically.
Thank you for explaining that to us. There are so many different aspects of how clearly there are economic aspects, social, cultural, political, you know, all sorts of different ways that this thing that seems very small, oh, it's a particular mushroom that people in Japan like, actually has all of the, you know, there's a lot more going on than that. And so kind of as we sort of finish up the interview, obviously, I think something that this encapsulates it in a lot of ways, that, you know, what a mushroom lives for. You might look at that title and go, okay, I have no idea. What does a mushroom live for? Huh, never really thought about that. And the book, as we've done in this interview, sort of starts from a sort of known quantity of like, mushrooms, cool, that's a thing. Some people really like to eat them. Okay. And then expands out into sort of philosophical questions of what is an animal, you know, scientific questions. Actually turns out there's this whole thing under the ground that we didn't know about until relatively recently and still have a lot to uncover, to something that has huge impacts on humans, both like literally in terms of, oh, look, you get money from this, but also in terms of revitalizing marginalized cultures and languages and all sorts of things. And so I think it's absolutely fascinating that kind of from this one seemingly small starting point, we've spread out into all these things, which also could be a metaphor of what a mushroom looks like as well, the visible expression of a massive network. So to stop me from rambling on further, I'd love to ask you about, now that this book is out, what are you working on now or next?
Well, I've got two main projects, one related to this and one pretty different, but it may have a few overlaps. So the one that's more related to this project is the idea for a follow-up book where I'm trying to build these alliances between different scientists who are working in a much more lively from a much more lively paradigm of how they interact with this with their different species. So in the book, I talk a lot about how there's this kind of deep rendering of different plants and fungi in a much more passive mode. And I've mentioned a few elements of that in the interview today. But I've been finding, you know, a handful of scholars who are using what's called an active niche hypothesis that shows how, you know, different organisms are reshaping their environment. They're not just, organisms do not just get shaped by the environment. So there's some kind of interesting reciprocity. So trying to foster connections between scientists who may not even really know of each other or think of themselves in this camp. And so that's something I've started to make some of these connections, especially with mycologists and botanists. And so I'd love to create a kind of forum that helps us in a broader way to both think critically about the existing frameworks that are hidden within mainstream biology and to help to proliferate another way of understanding the natural world that is both, you know, part of peer-reviewed science and helps motivate peer-reviewed science. So it's not just purely in the kind of woo-woo category, but is trying to ask different sets of questions and try to figure out how to explore that and to recognize the world-making capacities of all beings. So that's one thing that I'm really excited about. And then another project that I just got support this a few months ago from the Guggenheim Foundation that I'm really excited about is to look at the ways that China is an incredibly important global player, but in ways that we often have no idea about. So I've been building relationships with different indigenous communities in Canada and then also in Japan. And so a lot of people don't know that in all of the world, in the 1970s, especially, and sometimes into the 80s, China was probably the most active supporter of different indigenous movements. And so Chinese authorities invited all indigenous delegations from Canada, from Japan, from New Zealand, from Australia, and probably others to go and to see what kinds of, you know, incredible things that they had done in terms of supporting what they were calling ethnic minority rights, how they had created this incredible university that had professors and students that were reading and writing and all of these different, what they were calling ethnic minority languages, that China was kind of trying to present itself as a, both a kind of leader of the third world and the kind of revolutionary model of what could be possible under communism, as well as a kind of early days example of multiculturalism that was supposedly, you know, respecting and nurturing the great ethnic diversity at a time that, you know, in Canada and Japan, Australia and New Zealand, there was very, very little of that. And so that these were really inspiring places to go. And I've been starting to interview some of these different indigenous leaders from Canada and Japan to try to understand then how it reshaped their vision of what was possible in their own place and how it began part of like the slow work of through many grassroots actions of kind of nurturing the possibilities of understanding oneself as part of the fourth world, as part of the indigenous world, and how that's then tried to explore how that has shaped the political and social conditions of being both in Japan and Canada, as well as more broadly. So I guess it, in some ways, it relates back to this idea of, or this fascination I have with China as playing these kind of surprising roles in what are kind of planetary shaping dynamics. So, but it's a bit of a pivot for sure.
Well, they both sound very interesting. So best of luck with that. But while you are off researching those two projects, listeners can read the book that we've been discussing, which again is titled What a Mushroom Lives For, Matsutake and the Worlds They Make, from Princeton University Press in 2022. Dr. Michael Hathaway, thank you so much for being with the podcast.
Thanks so much for the invitation and the amazing conversation. I so enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.